And, well, we'll get as much of Margaret's question in as possible. All right, Margaret, what's up?
It's Margit.
Margit.
Which, I don't know if it makes any difference or not.
I'm not wearing my glasses. So
all right, so I'm not hearing your whatever. my question was, and I believe I heard your guests say, the people, and I assume they are in people form, though I'm not sure of that, came here and were looking for gold. Now,
there's our music.
Yeah, I hear that. All right. I would like to continue that.
I want you to stay right on there if you don't mind sitting.
I would love to.
Because that's what he said. And we'll let him elaborate on that just a little bit more. It's Open Mind tonight. I'm Bill Jenkins, and delighted to have in studio with me Mr. Zachariah Sitchin, the author of The Wars of Gods and Men. And that's what we're talking about tonight. Get your questions ready. We have two more hours, so come on in. Two of Open Mind tonight. I'm Bill Jenkins, and with me in studio, Zachariah Sitchin. And we're talking about book three of his Earth Chronicles called The Wars of Gods and Men. And as you've been listening, we're not talking about science fiction. Or if we are, we're talking about some elaborate science fiction that was written over 6,000 years ago, in which they talked of nuclear holocaust and flying ships and spaceports and things that I defy you to say that those people could have thought of on their own. Most likely they were historians. And we had Margaret on the line who wanted to know about the matter of gold entering into this scenario. Margaret, let's continue.
Yes, because to me gold is sort of so earthbound, I wondered why they would indeed want it.
Well, you weren't listening, Margaret.
Well, I guess I wasn't.
Okay.
So explain it to me simply. I'm a very simple person.
Okay, in simple terms, they did not come here for gold, for jewelry, or for any other such purpose, you know, frivolous purpose.
Yes.
They came here because they needed the gold for their survival on their own planet.
In what way? What would they need the gold for?
Well, okay.
I mean, I'm just asking.
No, it's okay, because obviously others helped me and you didn't, but their planet has a vast elliptical orbit.
Mm-hmm.
Goes very far out in space, and once in 3,600 years comes into the vicinity of Earth.
Mm-hmm.
They developed a problem on their planet that their atmosphere was eroding. They were losing their atmosphere and thus were at the risk of perishing on their planet.
Mm-hmm.
They have discovered, their scientists have discovered, that if they would suspend gold particles in their atmosphere, they would create a sheath, a covering, to protect their atmosphere and their planet. And as Bill said before, they would create a greenhouse effect that would also help them retain the heat generated by their planet.
Mm.
And thus they came here in search of gold, having discovered, and I also told how they happened to have found out that there is gold on Earth. They came here for that purpose. Their survival depended on it. They did not need it for jewelry.
No, I'm sure not. I simply wondered why.
Well, I don't know. As a woman, why are you sure not?
Pardon me?
As a woman, why are you sure they did not come here for jewelry?
Well, now that just smacks of the Earth, my dear. Not another planet. I hope there aren't other male chauvinists out there.
As a matter of fact, some of their leaders were women. And if Bill will let me, I'll tell you a little about it.
Well, I would like to say to Bill, this man has an awful lot of earthbound qualities to him. I'm sorry. That was not my intent. As a matter of fact, I was thinking of gold fillings, if anything.
Oh, Margaret, but I hope that answers your question.
Well, indeed it does, and it also answered my other question, which was gold per se, and jewelry was not my idea of it. You know, there's a heart of gold.
We were kind of joshing with you a little bit there,
right.
Margaret.
Well, and I'm joshing with you, too, you know.
Okay,
I'm going to call you back, Bill.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Now. Bye.
Thank you very much. We have a lot of fun with our gang out there. Okay, Donald.
Hi, how are you, Bill, tonight?
All right.
Two questions. One, if these people were viewing from outer space onto Earth, why was such importance given to the Earth moon and all the moons of the other planets ignored? Wouldn't they see those from a different viewpoint, too?
Well, you said you have two questions.
Yeah.
What's
Can we try that one or not?
Well, it's up to Bill.
Well, go right ahead and answer whatever.
Okay. Now, according to the Sumerian cosmology, the moon was in the process of becoming a celestial body, a planet in its own right. That is why it was considered to be a 12th member of the solar system, unlike the other moons or moonlets of which we know. Another one that was a moon of another planet and became a planet itself is Pluto. This is a theory that most astronomers today subscribe to, but which is described by the Sumerians in their writings 6,000 years ago. So there were two celestial bodies, one that became the planet Pluto, and one was our moon, which they called Kingu, which was in the process of becoming a planet, but due to celestial collisions and other events, which they described and I described in my first book, The 12th Planet, it didn't become a planet on its own right, but they still considered it to be a celestial body in its own right, nevertheless.
So just those two, Pluto might have been a moon, and our moon were the only two important ones.
Right.
The other moons were unimportant.
The other moons remained satellites of other planets, and therefore they were not in the same category.
Okay. If the desert goes from the Mediterranean, would it include the Gobi Desert? Would it go all the way to China? And then my question is, did the Chinese give any accounts of these incidents?
Well, the prevailing winds carry the nuclear cloud from the Sinai Peninsula, from the shores of the Mediterranean Sea, towards Mesopotamia. Beyond Mesopotamia, there are the mountains, the Zagros Mountains, which would protect the area leading into what is today Iran, or formerly known as Persia, India, and so on.
How far
the cloud went on, I do not know, because I'm relying on the Sumerian writings, and since their civilization perished as a result of that cloud, they were not allowed to write and tell us more. Now, the Chinese civilization came much, much later, because we are talking about people, the Sumerians, who started to write and build high-rise buildings, seven-story buildings, and have law courts and courts and even juries, by the way. 6,000 years ago, and the Chinese civilization, as far as we know, is much younger. So I cannot really answer you whether or not this nuclear cloud was carried as far as China.
Does that help you, Donald?
Okay, fine. Thank you.
For those who may have just tuned in, you missed the first hour in which we talked about the fact that in the year 2024 B.C., that there was quite a nuclear war in what would now be centered in what is now the Sinai Peninsula.
Right.
And created a great deal of damage. And this information and the descriptions of the nuclear war and the blast and the radioactive cloud is all caught up in the ancient Sumerian text, of which Zachariah Sitchin, who's our guest tonight, has written a book called The Wars of Gods and Men. And if you just joined us, settle in, because we're going to pull your string just a little bit tonight. And we invite you to call in and talk to Zachariah if you want to. Let me give you a couple of the numbers. In Los Angeles, 520-TALK. San Fernando Valley, your number 990. San Gabriel Valley, your 448. And I'll be right back with Zachariah in just a moment. We're talking about his new book, The Wars of Gods and Men. By the way, Zachariah, you're going to be appearing tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us where and all about that?
I'll be lecturing and having discussions with Elizabeth Clare Prophet at the Summit University tomorrow at 3 o'clock. The address is 26800 West Mulholland Highway.
Mulholland, yeah, Mulholland Highway.
Calabasas.
Way out there, but it's worth going out there to see you and hear all about it in person.
Well, they can hear me tonight, but they can't see me tonight, unfortunately, right? And I'm reading here that for information, one could call 818-880-5300.
All right. And we'll give you that information a couple of other times. Zachariah's book is Avon, available all over.
May I mention a competing station?
You certainly may.
Monday morning, I'm on the mid-morning LA show on Channel 9.
Mm-hmm. With our good friend Jeff Edwards. And they'll treat you right over there.
Thank you.
And Miss McRae, she's also there. Meredith. We have Bob on the line. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Bill. Hello, Zachariah.
Good afternoon. Good evening. I'm just flew in from New York, so.
Okay.
He doesn't know what time of day.
Right.
Okay. Bill, are you familiar with the Rye maps of Alexandria, Egypt?
I thought I was pretty familiar with Egyptology, but that one escapes me. The Rye maps? How do you spell it?
R-I. Re or Rye.
Map?
Mm-hmm.
A map? An actual map?
Yeah. Basically, from what I've gathered was that these were copies from previous maps.
I think you're talking about the Reis map. R-I-I-S.
Okay.
Right. Which was found originally in Asia Minor in Turkey.
Yes, and
which seems to delineate the American continent and Antarctica when it was not covered by ice, right?
Yes.
Yes.
And its center was located in the similar area to where you said that spaceport earlier was.
Yes.
I was wondering if the Sumerians had any reference or correlation to the Egyptian maps.
What?
And how they would be connected together, because the Egyptians have always been associated with the gods and stuff like that, just like the Sumerians.
Yes, I can recommend to you a terrific book which will answer that question in detail.
Okay.
That's my book. It's titled The Wars of Gods and Men, and the previous one, The Stairway to Heaven, which bring into the total picture, because it is, as you say, one tale, one story and one history, brings into the picture and correlates with the Sumerian tales and civilization, the Egyptian mythologies, the pyramid texts, and so on. And the Sumerians definitely were aware of the pyramids. They were aware of the Egyptian beliefs. And indeed, the Egyptians said that their gods have come to Egypt through the Red Sea from a place called Urta. Urta is taken to mean the ancient or the olden place, but the name Ur, or Er as it many pronounce it, should strike a bell, because that was one of the principal cities in Mesopotamia, in ancient Sumer, and the one from which Abraham came. So the Egyptians knew that their so-called gods had come from Mesopotamia, and they were one and the same as the Sumerian ones.
Okay, thank you very much for the information.
You know,
I listen all the time.
All right, thank you very much, Bob. Appreciate that.
Bye.
More and more, it seems, whenever we're talking about the ancient text and the ancient writers, even the writers of the Bible, when they talk about gods, they're not talking about gods at all. They're talking about other mortal human beings.
Yes, well, they were in a way considered immortal, and that needs some explaining. But the ancient peoples, Bill, did not call them gods at all. This is a term that I use simply because that's how people have come to learn the gods of Egypt, the Greek gods, Zeus and Aphrodite and so on. The Greeks were the first ones that coined the term Deus, which is an Indo-European word, which meant, by the way, the shiny one, also not God. But this is where we got this concept of God with the lowercase g.
Mm-hmm.
The Sumerians called them Anunnaki, which literally meant those who from heaven came to earth, which takes us back to the meaning of the word Nephilim in the Bible. And the Old Testament, in other chapters, of the book of Genesis and even later on says that the Nephilim were the same and part of the Anakim. And as I explained in my latest book, Anakim was simply, it's taken to mean giants again, was simply the Hebrew for Anunnaki, the Sumerian word. So these are the ones who from heaven came to earth. The Egyptians called, the so-called gods of Egypt, called them Netero, which means the guardians. So none of the ancient peoples, the Babylonians called them Elo, which meant the lofty ones. None of them used the word God. It is only a concept that we have acquired from Greek words, Greek terminology.
All right. And we are going to get into a good deal more of that with you and Zachariah Sitchin tonight. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind.
Based on his own personal experiences to teach people to experience expanded states of awareness, including the out-of-body state. We talk about that a lot here. The Gateway Weekend Workshop is a 3-day workshop. Now, the next that will be given is July 26th, 27th, and 28th. Robert Monroe, who will be a guest on the show again here in a few weeks, has developed a patented process called Hemisync. It's been determined that certain audio pulse frequencies, when heard through stereo headphones, will create expanded states of awareness. This process is used in the Gateway Weekend Workshop. Now, if you'd like more information, and I hope you do, call area code 213-393-9405. Monroe also offers a home study course of cassette tapes. To get more information on the Gateway Weekend Workshop or on the cassette tapes, call area code 213-393-9405. And they're ready to talk to you right now. Or attend their free lecture on July 18th. Call for more information. Area code 213-393-9405. We're 28 minutes past 10 on this Saturday night. It's Open Mind with me, Zachariah Sitchin. His book, The Gods of Wars and Men. And Dan is on the line. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Bill. Hello, Mr. Sitchin. Mr. Sitchin, I'm particularly interested in the pyramid forgeries that you wrote about in The Stairway to Heaven.
Yes.
And I also wrote to you regarding that. Thank you for your kind response, sir. And regarding those forgeries, I'm curious as to whether academic archaeology is doing anything to investigate the forgeries or your hypothesis.
Well, let me tell you this first of all. In the Stairway to Heaven, which you mentioned, I arrived at the conclusion that the inscription attributing the construction of the Great Pyramid of Giza to the Pharaoh Cheops, or Khufu in Egyptian, was actually a forgery perpetrated in 1837. By a British colonel by name of Howard Wisey, or his assistant, a fellow called Hill. That conclusion was reached by me based on a lot of evidence from that time and from research done by me afterwards at the British Museum. And that is where I left it. In other words, it was like a detective effort to show who the culprit was, and I left it at that. What you may not know, or others who have read the book, which was published in 1980, you may not know, is that about less than 2 years ago, I received a letter from an engineer in Pittsburgh. And he wrote to me and said, Mr. Sitchin, I read your book, The Stairway to Heaven, and what you say about the forgery in the Great Pyramid has been known in my family for the past 150 years. When I read that, I was flabbergasted. I called him by phone, and I said to him, Mr. Allen, what do you mean it has been known in your family for 150 years? How could that be? Well, he said, here is the story, and afterwards he sent me family records to support what he said. He said his great-grandfather was a master mason in England and went to Egypt at the time that Howard Wisey was there in order to help build an eye hospital for the Egyptians who were working for Colonel Wisey inside the pyramid. That plan did not materialize for various reasons, which Weise also mentions in his diaries. And therefore, that Master Mason was asked or offered a job by Mr. Weise to work inside the pyramid, because Weise was getting desperate for some kind of a discovery, having spent 2 years and the family fortune searching inside the pyramid, finding nothing. And Weise decided to use gunpowder to blast his way through the pyramid to what he thought were secret or hidden chambers. They did find so-called chambers of construction, which had a different purpose entirely, some mentioned by me in the second book, some in the new book. And those chambers of construction had a few markings, according to Weise there, which he showed to the British consul in Cairo and the Austrian consul, and they crawled in and signed a document, a facsimile of those writings that supposedly spelled the name of Khufu, and lodged them in the British Museum. I, by the way, was the only one in 150 years that asked to see that, and it took some time at the museum to find it for me. Now, my conclusion was that those erroneous hieroglyphics done by an amateur were really painted by Mr. Hill, and I pinpointed the night in which he went in to do that with paint and brush. The great-grandfather of the gentleman from Pittsburgh witnessed it and wrote to his father in England and said, I saw Mr. Hill go with brush and paint on the pretext that he was going in to make more legible signs that were there, but in fact he was writing new signs and forging the name of the pharaoh. That great-grandfather wrote it to his father. After that, he was fired by Weise and never permitted to come back to the pyramid. Those letters from Egypt were part of the archives that the family took to the United States when they migrated from England to upstate New York, and that gentleman from Pittsburgh knew of them, saw them, recorded the tales of the family of his mother and his aunt about those letters and the incident, and thus there appeared about 2 years ago literally an eyewitness to the forgery, an eyewitness to something that happened 150 years ago.
That's absolutely fascinating. And I think if academic archaeology ever gets around to the business of investigating it, this is really going to rock the basis of Egyptian chronology, isn't it?
Well, not of Egyptian chronology, but of the assumption that Khufu built the Great Pyramid, that his successor built the second large pyramid, that their successor built the third one, and so on. That definitely does not hold water anymore.
I have one more question, if I could ask it. Mr. Sitchin, have you also considered an alternative interpretation of history, one that might include past high civilizations that are of Earth origin, like the Atlantis myth or the Lemuria myth?
Well, I did not have to consider it because we know of it. Because according to the Sumerian texts and according to the biblical version, a much shortened version of those texts, there was a civilization on Earth quite advanced. At least they knew of metallurgy, they knew of musical instruments, just to give a few examples of what that civilization had. That existed before the deluge. Now, the deluge, according to my sources and calculations, happened about 12 to 13,000 years ago, which is at least 6,000-7,000 years before the Sumerian civilization, which was a post-diluvial civilization. So the Sumerians themselves and the Old Testament, quoting the same original sources, do tell us of a civilization even before the deluge, which was, of course, wiped out by the deluge.
Have you, if you're interested in Atlantis, have you read Charles Berlitz's book on it?
Yes, I have. Very interesting, Bill.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
All right, Dan.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Appreciate the question. And we're 36 minutes past the 10 o'clock mark, about the halfway mark on our night with Zachariah Sitchin and his new book, The Gods of War and Men. And, Ben, you're on.
Zachariah?
Yes?
Two quick questions. Did any of these alien people remain on Earth? And are their descendants here amongst us now?
Well, you want to know more than I say in my books.
Well, but absolutely. I'm talking about your next book.
That's right. Give me a chance to write it.
You're a very psychic person, Ben.
Well, what do you think, Zachariah, or would you rather pass on that question?
Well, let me give you a clever answer. In a way, we are all descendants of them. That is your second question.
Okay.
Because the story that comes out of the Sumerian writings of the depictions is that when they came here and when they had to resort to the onerous task of getting their gold through mining and no longer through a sophisticated process, just by processing the waters of the Persian Gulf. At some point, which is described in the first book, those who were working in the mines mutinied. The description, by the way, Bill, of the mutiny is so vivid, it's as if somebody is describing the the march on the Bastille in France, with the torches, with what was burned down, how they surrounded the home of the commander and really kept him in house arrest until he agreed to their demands.
Now, the people that were working in the mines, were they from the other planet?
Yes, they were part of the 600 who landed on Earth.
That's when they started making people.
Right. Now, the solution that they found, and again, the solution was offered by Enki, who was the scientific leader, to the problem, because those who were here refused to continue mining. They had to get the gold for their survival. So he said, there is a being on Earth which already exists. Those, by the way, Bill, are the words of the Sumerian text.
Mm-hmm.
The being already exists. All we have to do is to put on it our imprint so that it could do the work for us.
Uh-huh.
And what they did was they took ape men, ape women, who were already on Earth through evolution. And through genetic manipulation, which is described again in great detail and even in pictures, which I reproduce, they jumped the gun on evolution. In other words, I believe that we, Homo sapiens, would have evolved on Earth anyway, but in another 5 or 10 or 20 million years. They jumped the gun, mixed their genetic material with that of ape woman, with the egg, fertilized the egg of ape woman, exactly, by the way, in a process that is now is called in vitro.
That's right.
And created about 300,000 years ago, us. They created Homo sapiens.
That makes sense.
So in a way, we are all descended of them, and that is what the Bible means by saying that we were created in there. By the way, the Bible uses the plural, not the singular. In their image and in their likeness.
Okay.
In their image physically and in their likeness mentally, morally,
that's
spiritually.
That's interesting. Second question. In your opinion, what does this all do to all the religious belief systems of a supernatural God, one person who created everything, in your opinion?
I think it upholds it.
It upholds a single God?
Of course.
That means, in what way does that do that? It's kind of interesting. How does that uphold a God that created Earth when we know that these people came from another planet?
Well, sir, I suppose you wouldn't, you know, take it amiss if I say, please read my books.
I will, absolutely.
Okay, because I end the first book, The 12th Planet.
Uh-huh.
I end it with the question, which, if Bill would lend me the copy, I'll read it to you.
Okay.
Now, the Bible called them, if you were tuned in before, Nephilim. The Sumerians called them Anunnaki. The Bible called those who came here Nephilim. And I explained how they, in quotes, created men, really did not create us, just advanced us genetically.
Uh-huh.
And the end, the very last sentence in my first book is the following. And I quote, "And if the Nephilim were the gods," in quotation marks, "who created," in quotation marks, "men on Earth, did evolution alone on the 12th planet create the Nephilim?" Question mark.
Very good.
In other words, there is a cycle, there is an endless process, and to think in terms, in religious terms, only as if there is a God that belongs only to this Earth, to
right.
this planet, I don't think this is...
The right
belief.
Did
if one says there must be a universal creator, one who may have preordained everything, one who created them and through them us, that, I think, is the answer to
I think we can add one more thing to that, Ben, that when you look at the Old and New Testament, that the term which we refer to God, the creator of the universe, appears only twice. And that's in the first chapter of Genesis.
Is there any mention?
And from then on, it's mentioning something else, which is human and origin.
Right. Is there any mention of these people believing in God?
Well, what we know, what the Sumerians know, was bequeathed to them and to us by them. So our beliefs are really their beliefs.
Okay, very good, and thank you kindly.
I want to fortify you just a little bit more on that, Ben. There's a book called The Genesis Mystery, and which it deals with anthropology. But suddenly, in a geological twinkling, there did appear on this planet what we would call a Cro-Magnon man, who for a while, in fact, coexisted with the Neanderthal man. And you have people like Dr. Crick, who discovered the DNA molecule, Jeffrey Goodman, who wrote that book, and another rather esteemed and highly held anthropologist, who call this the intervention,
right.
and say by no way could this have happened by Darwinian evolutionary processes.
Right, okay. Thank you kindly.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you for your question. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me tonight, Zachariah Sitchin. 2 years has already resulted in the death of over 430 Americans, the destruction of half of our corn crop, and probably the marvelous weather we're enjoying right now can be attributed to the bending of the jet streams. You'll find the science behind it, how it's done, where it's coming from. The Weather War with Tom Bearden. 2 weeks from tonight. But right now we have Zachariah Sitchin with us. We're talking about The Wars of Gods and Men. It's his latest book, his third book in a series called The Earth Chronicles. And it's a fascinating story that tells us of the first nuclear holocaust, 2,024 years before Christ. And that ought to get your attention. Let's see if it's gotten Carol's attention. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I have a question for Mr. Sitchin. Now, in his first book, he says that he talks about Enki, and later he tells us about his son Marduk. Now, in the last book, he still talks about Enki as living, and Marduk as living, and that's about 450,000 years. So, what I would like to know is, are Enki and Marduk still living? And if they are they living on this planet? And if they are, where?
Well, it's a good question that gives me a chance to answer something that I think Bill wanted me to say, but we were interrupted by a commercial break.
Imagine that.
Yeah, interfering with history. It did take, as far as we count the years, let's say almost 500,000, roughly, give or take, a few thousand years, from the landing until the time, say, of Abraham, of the nuclear holocaust, which I deal with in the third book. And you're right in pointing that out. I could even say that you must assume, as I did, that Enki, if he were chosen to lead the first landing party on Earth, he must have been already somewhat mature even then. 20 years, 30 years old, etc.
Right.
Now, what is a year that we call a year? A year is really the time that the planet on which we live and on which we were born, the time it takes that planet to orbit around the sun, right?
Right,
that's,
I know.
1 year.
You explained that in the your first book.
Yeah, I know, but I'm answering questions for the million 300,000 listeners, as I understand, are listening to us this moment, and not just to you. So, to them, 1 year was really the time it took their planet to orbit around the sun. In our terms, it is 3,600 Earth years. But to them, it is just 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's say 360,000